From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan, as the leader of the state Democratic Party himself, has pointed out in recent statements, has not been indicted or otherwise accused by prosecutors of any wrongdoing. But he is the focus of a rare legislative investigation that is just getting started.
I will now state the charge in which I will ask for the committee's consideration and ask that it be entered into the record. Representative Madigan engaged in conduct which is unbecoming to a legislator or which constitutes a breach of public trust, as detailed in the admissions by Commonwealth Edison and the Deferred Prosecution Agreement, including engaging in a bribery scheme, an extortion scheme, conspiracy to violate federal and state laws, amongst other misconduct and misuse of the office.
That's the Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin at the start of a special investigative committee looking into House Speaker Michael Madigan, who's been implicated in a bribery scheme. The hearings could lead to discipline, even removal from office. We'll talk about all that and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel is practicing social distancing once again. From his home, Charlie Wheeler, who's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, and he's also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also with us, we have Jamie Monks. She covers state government and politics for the Chicago Tribune. And Jamie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Chris Mooney is with us once again. He's a professor of state politics at the University of Illinois Chicago and a former regular panelist on this show. And Chris, it's good to have you back.
Thanks, Sean.
Well, as we discussed last week, three Republicans, including the House Republican leader Jim Durkin, filed a petition to create a committee to investigate the House Speaker and Democrat Michael Madigan. The first hearing of a bipartisan committee was held this week. And Jamie, you covered this. It was more organizational. I think it lasted about a half an hour. But did we learn anything about how this process is going to work from that brief time?
You're right. So it was a fairly brief and basic organizational meeting, given the scope of what this committee is being asked to consider. But what they actually did was they read the petition into the record that House Republican leader Jim Durkin submitted last week that triggered this whole process, this disciplinary proceeding. And they also read into the record this charge that the committee is going to have to weigh and decide whether there are grounds for disciplining Speaker Madigan. One of the first tasks that the chairman, Representative Welch, wants to undertake is to reach out to the U.S. Attorney's Office and ensure that this legislative panel, their effort, their work here, isn't going to be something that interferes with this ongoing federal investigation. So that's about the bulk of the actual action that was undertaken yesterday. We don't actually know when the committee will meet again. They want to get that feedback from the U.S. Attorney's Office before they do so. But one thing the Republicans are pushing for, the three Republican members, is to hear from Speaker Madigan directly, as well as some other folks who have been implicated in this federal investigation. So that includes former ComEd lobbyists and executives, They submitted this witness list. They want to hear from those people directly. We don't know at this point whether that will actually happen or not. But that was another one of the things that we learned yesterday. We also know that Speaker Madigan will be given an opportunity if he wants to participate in this process to testify, and he and his attorney will also have the opportunity to look at any evidence that's submitted.
Now, Charlie, the speaker could testify. He doesn't have to, and in fact, he's called this a political stunt in a press release that was sent out. which in fact kind of seemed a little tone deaf to me, considering the charges. They're pretty serious that are there. Your thoughts on, you know, what the speaker might do here, or do you have any feel that he is actually going to participate in these?
I would guess probably not, or if he does, he'll do it in a very limited fashion. I think, as Jamie said, though, one of the considerations is the Republicans had a laundry list of people who've been named as being involved in this whole scheme that they want to bring in before the committee. And if I'm the U.S. attorney, do I want people who are potentially going to be part of my the details that I will lay out, I'm hoping, before a federal jury or a federal judge at some point? Do I want these people kind of testifying in other venues? And there's kind of precedent, and this goes back, 14 years. If you guys recall, when Rob Blagojevich was running for re-election, Lisa Madigan had been looking into allegations of hiring mispractice, basically hiring people for patronage purposes. And she actually got a letter from then U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald thanking her for halting her investigations. And what he said in the letter is, the most important consideration for both our offices is that the very serious allegations of endemic hiring fraud be thoroughly and expeditiously investigated and, if appropriate, prosecuted. So he asked Madigan to back off so that he could prosecute this hiring fraud. Sort of the irony here is, I'm sure you recall, is that when the charges were finally brought against Blagojevich, hiring fraud was not part of it at all. It was trying to shake down people for campaign contributions.
Well, Chris, whether or not the speaker decides to participate or how far this goes or whatever response the federal prosecutor makes, some are going to see that as a stall tactic. I mean, some people out there are going to say, well, the Democrats are trying to push this thing off a bit by saying we're going to defer to the feds. That's, I think Charlie makes a good point about, how this legal working could play out. But at the same time, in the court of public opinion, it's going to look a lot different.
Yeah. And then, shockingly, there's politics involved here. It's a strategic dance. Everybody's trying to figure out how they can get some advantage. Republicans are, they're pushing for it so they can, and they put a couple of their targets on the committee so they can, hopefully be seen as grilling Madigan or whoever at some point. The Democrats, of course, are, the speaker put on basically loyalists on his side. Are they going to, the Democrats going to try to drag this out, and are the Republicans going to try to jack this up in the media? Yep, absolutely. That's what's going to happen. Is there going to be an impact? Probably not, because most of the time, maybe on public opinion, but not on government. Because whenever, it's a classic, this is not just Illinois, but Illinois does this in spades, is that when, government sets up, when the politicians set up ethics supervision and stuff, they make it very difficult to do anything to anybody, right? So, the legislature says, it's just like an industry regulating itself, right? So you're, let's say in the paper industry, you're doing a lot of pollution, that if you don't get it together and your colleagues, other paper mills don't get together and calm down the pollution, the government's going to step in and really regulate it like crazy. So a lot of trade associations, they try to regulate themselves and try to show that they're good citizens and so forth. It's the same exact thing with the lead. But what they're doing is they're trying to head off more restrictive regulations. It's the same thing with this. We're setting up a committee and, we've got this institution, but it's, you can see where, how effective it's going to be by the two rules. Number one, it's evenly balanced on party, which is unusual in the legislative process. There's only one other one. I think Jay Carr is the only one I know, probably another one or two. But anyway, so it's evenly balanced on party, and a majority has to vote to send it out. And so, in other words, you got to get somebody from the other party, one person on that committee from the other party has to vote to proceed with the investigation. And that's only going to happen in a rare situation where you've got bipartisan agreement that this person is bad. You know, there's some problem with this person, like Derek Smith, whatever that was, 8 years ago. They threw him out. Everybody, you know, straight up bribery. They had the goods on him, you know. And there was no strong partisan reason to deal with it because he was coming from, I think he was the west side of Chicago, which is a Democratic area. So that wasn't a concern. So this one, you know, this committee, you know, the Republicans may get some information out of here that might be useful, but it seems mostly that this is just everybody dancing around waiting for the election.
Well, you mentioned how the it's evenly split, 3-3. Jamie, if I understand this right, this committee does have subpoena power, but it takes a majority vote to issue a subpoena. So again, if they want to subpoena Mike Madigan or somebody else, they're going to need at least one Democrat to come over to the Republican side. Is that right?
Right, right. So, you know, that's another area where, you know, it would be challenging, I think, probably for them to get to that point. And I think, you know, even if they were to authorize a charge, which, you know, as has been mentioned, that seems fairly unlikely, at that point, then an additional disciplinary committee would be created, which would then have to recommend discipline to the full House of Representatives. So even if that, you know, we were to get to that situation, to get to that stage, there are more steps from here, you know, before any discipline could actually come down.
Charlie,
and that additional committee is made up of 12 people, 6 Republicans and 6 Democrats, correct?
Right.
And it's important to point out at this point, this is not a Democratic scheme or cabal to make this not happen. This is a bipartisan scheme cabal to make this not happen. Right? They set this institution up to make it difficult. And Democrats and Republicans are both on it. Just so happens today, the Republicans are using it. But they were complicit in setting the system up, so they can't complain about it.
Yeah, actually, this predates Mike Madigan's time as Speaker. It was put in place 44 years ago when a Republican charged the Democratic Majority Leader with inappropriate behavior. The leader was absolved by the House by a wide margin. And this rule was put in place back then in 1976 when Madigan was like an assistant majority leader, but Bill Redman from Bensonville was the speaker. And I think the reason that it's balanced out is to guarantee that the majority won't run roughshod over the minority. This is one of the few legislative entities in either the Senate or the House that would require equal numbers of majority and minority. Usually, the majority will have a lopsided advantage on all the other committees.
Well, Chris, going back to what you had mentioned there as far as you know, both parties involved, the thing that I guess Mike Madigan might have to fear the most will be facing the Democrats come January when they elect a new House Speaker. It may be one of those things, it seems to me, where if I'm a Democrat, I'm going to say, you know, I'm not going to listen to the Republicans to tell me what to do. But when we get past this point, all things being equal, no additional charges or anything like that filed at this point in this election, that Madigan could have a bit of a difficult time gaining re-election to be House Speaker if he decides to run for that in January.
I would say that depends on events between then and now. If nothing changes, as your scenario, if there's no more indictments, if no more testimony and whatnot, I don't think he's going to have any problem. He has his system down, his election system. He doesn't force members to vote for things they don't want to vote for that are bad for their districts. He's all about re-election and keeping the Democrats in a majority in the House. And there's been that tossed up from time to time over the years about Madigan, and obviously lots of concerns and lots of accusations and whatnot. But he's never been indicted. He's never been no crimes or even strong suggestions that he personally was doing any of this stuff, right? So without new information, Democrats will probably, the inclination is, like they say, you go home with the one that brought you to the dance. He's the one that set this system up that allowed the Democrats to win, in addition to the demographic changes of the state for the last 20 years. So unless something changes, if nothing comes out more, if the Democrats do well in the election, why would they? Why would they change? They saw the result. Now, if on the other hand, they get beat badly in legislative races and a matter of members at rate, an issue, if there's an indictment of him or somebody close to him or something like that, and more testimony comes out, yeah, then all bets are off.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Professor Chris Mooney of the University of Illinois Chicago, and the Chicago Tribune's Jamie Monks. Jamie, let me turn to you, staying on the investigation front. A subpoena was issued to the Democrat and Senate President Don Herman's office, and this was issued a bit earlier this summer, but I think the news on it just finally came out recently. What do we know about that? And also, I believe there's a Madigan tie to this story as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what we know at this point is that Senate President Don Harmon's office is one of the various entities that has been subpoenaed around the same time that Speaker Madigan's office was subpoenaed back earlier in the summer, around the time that this ComEd deferred prosecution agreement was made public. So the U.S. Attorney's Office was asking Harmon's office in this subpoena to turn over any documents or any communications related to this specific piece of property in Chicago in Chinatown, which is owned by the state and is currently in use as a parking lot. So specifically, they were looking for communications with Speaker Madigan, with former state senator Martin Sandoval, as well as lobbyists or former lobbyists, including Michael McLean, who is a longtime close ally of Speaker Madigan's. In addition to that, they were also seeking information related to a particular piece of legislation. So I'll just say at this point, there's no indication that the Senate president is being targeted here in the investigation, based on what we see in this subpoena. Everything that was being sought seems to be related to this one piece of property. Senate President Harmon's office actually turned over was this packet of information related to that specific piece of legislation that was named in this subpoena, this land transfer bill. And ultimately, when the bill was being considered at the committee level in the Senate and the final version of the bill, that piece of property wasn't included in it. So what we actually see here isn't a lot of what was being sought by the U.S. Attorney's Office, where we don't see the Senate President's Office turning over communications with any of these particular people regarding this piece of property.
Let me also switch gears here in the time we have left to talk about Ken Griffin. His name comes up from time to time on this show. Considered the state's richest man and one of the richest in the world, he has weighed in now on the graduated income tax, both in words and in money. He's written a commentary that appeared in newspapers and also decided to the tube also contribute $20 million, which for him is not nearly as much as it sounds to me, but he's given $20 million to the campaign that is fighting against changing Illinois' tax structure from a flat to a graduated rate. He says that will lead to higher taxes for all. He's gone on to say that a couple of tax increases have already failed to improve our financial situation, and he basically says this is no more than a scheme engineered to extract the greatest amount of money possible from all Illinois taxpayers. So Jamie, this thing is starting to really heat up now. We've got two big players, J.B. Pritzker giving a lot of money on one side in favor of the graduated tax, Griffin on the other.
Right. So it's kind of a battle of the billionaires at this point over the graduated income tax. And, you know, I think that it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out leading up to November, because I think that, you know, the governor has made the point that given the pandemic and given the depleted revenues the state has seen as a result of that this is more needed than ever. And, you know, at the same time, as we've discussed extensively on the show so far, you have this federal investigation that's ongoing. And so I think that that could potentially give some more weight to this opposition side, which is making the case that, you know, voters shouldn't trust Springfield politicians, and pointing to past fiscal mismanagement and the pension debt and everything. So, you know, I think there might be a little bit of a bandwidth issue here too with the pandemic and with everything else that's going on. You know, getting people to really sign on to this issue and this proposal, I think that makes it that all the more challenging too.
Yeah, and Charlie, do you think you know, the Madigan stuff, I'm sure it doesn't help in this fight for the graduated tax. Do you think voters can separate the two and make a decision based on what they think is the best way to go and not include all of that?
Yeah, I think people probably can. I mean, there are some people who are going to say, oh, if Madigan's for it, I'm against it. Doesn't matter what it is. And I think there are other people who will analyze it and say, am I going to be better off or worse off if this passes? And for the majority of the people, they will be better off. They will be paying less money in state income taxes. And I think that's one of the things the proponents have going for them, is they have down in black and white, if this amendment passes, here's what the rates will be. Only 3% of Illinois taxpayers will pay more. The opponents have to argue, well, that's only for now, and you can't really trust them, because as soon as they do that, they'll start to tax retirement income, and they'll start to change the brackets so that middle-class taxpayers will have to pay more. So it's more a question of, here's what the actual law will be, and on the other hand, here are my fears about what might happen if we allow this. Of course, it should be noted that it doesn't matter whether there's a constitutional amendment or not. You can still raise income taxes, just do it with majority votes in both the House and the Senate and have the governor sign it. But if voters are really interested, the Secretary of State distributed the informational packet on the proposed amendment. It went out this week, came through the mail, and it lays out, here's what the language is, here's what the people who are for it say, here's what the people who are against it say. And so I would suggest anyone who's not sure, read that pamphlet so that you're well-informed, then make up your mind based on that.
You know, earlier this year, I assumed all summer long, and right now we'd be talking quite a bit about the graduated income tax. That was, you know, pre-pandemic, pre-Michael Madigan and this investigation and everything else that's gone on. And Chris, just about a minute or so left here, but I'm not hearing from a lot of people about this issue as much as I thought I would be. Again, I think Jamie pointed out there may be a bandwidth issue out there. There's so many things on people's minds right now. Is this getting lost in the shuffle?
Yeah, I think that's what's going on. As with all this money, there's going to be more ads on TV. It's a fairly straightforward issue for people to spin one way or the other, right? They got a good story on one side and good story on the other. As Charlie says, it's going to be a matter of trust. But one of the problems that the proponents of this have is that trust in the Illinois government is about lower than a snake's belly, as my dad used to say. And what you have to do is, you have to say, yes, they're benevolent. They will help us. And you have a lot of people on the con side who are going to be stoking those fears, as you just mentioned. Ken Griffin, $20 million bucks. I'd like to know if that's more or less than he would pay in extra taxes in 1 year after this thing passes. I think that would be interesting to know. It's going to come up near the end. And the problem that the pro people have is they've got to get 60% positive voting. I mean, they've got to get over a threshold here, and that may be difficult.
Okay, it's time now for our notes from the field. And Charlie, let's go to you first.
Well, we've been talking about taxes and money. The State Department of Revenue reported that the recreational marijuana tax produced $19.2 million in taxes in its August report. And the way it works is these would have been on recreational marijuana that was sold during the month of July, because there's like a month delay. But it's interesting to note that in the same month, the state collected $26 million in liquor taxes. So the $19 million from pot is getting close to what we collect from booze.
All right, and Chris?
I wanted to point out that this week, in another sign of the apocalypse, former GOP state party chair Pat Brady endorsed Democratic Representative Kasten in the 6th Congressional District against the Republican opposition, Jeannie Ives. And what this demonstrates is, again, the split in the Republican Party, both at the national level and at the state level, between sort of the older school, sort of Reagan, Bush, institutional Republicans versus Donald Trump and those kind of Republicans. And this is something that will be sorted out in the next year after this election. It'll be very interesting to watch.
All right. And Jamie?
Yeah, just a quick tidbit to mark the passage of time in 2020. This week actually marked the 6 month point since the governor issued that statewide disaster proclamation back in March related to COVID-19. And it's also been 6 months since the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus pandemic. And so as we approach this next season change, as everybody's probably seen, public health officials are pushing pretty hard for people to get flu vaccines as early as possible. One bit of potentially bright news, though, in some recent discussions with public health officials, they've been sort of heartened to see that the Southern Hemisphere's flu season has been fairly light so far, and I think hope that we see the same thing here.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Jamie Monks from the Chicago Tribune, and UIC professor Chris Mooney. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.